Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, Spotlight Africa with the Grand Master of the Order of Malta. Introduction to the most important lyrical poet of the 20th century in Germany. His name, Rainer Maria Rilke. And a jaunt to Rome's Bernini Fountain in Piazza Navona. Well, let's join the Grand Master of the Sovereign Order of Malta, Fra Matthew Festing, as he speaks to Emma McCarthy on the occasion of the launching of a series of seminars hosted by the International Relations Department of the American University of Rome this past Wednesday.
Speak to us a little bit about the health of this centuries-old order that has been such a vital part of the life of the Church.
Well, the reason I think we've survived is that we have had, over the centuries, a method of succeeding in changing all the time, reacting to circumstances, not only being reactive, but I suppose proactive too. Because any organisation which is going to last 50 years, never mind 900 years, has to change from time to time. And if you stay in a completely static way, of course, that simply doesn't happen because you get left behind by circumstances. So we try, whatever, you know, over the centuries, to react to the situations we find ourselves in. And so we are a complicated organisation because we're a religious order. We are an order of the Catholic Church, which is obviously that. Then we are a sovereign entity, which is another very odd aspect of it, unlike anybody else. And then, of course, we are now very much involved and have been actually always, but in a particular way now, very, very heavily involved in a lot of the developing countries around the world, where we have various programs to help people. And also, we react when there are various forms of natural disaster. So Haiti would be a particularly good example. But the tsunami and various earthquakes which have taken place over the years, we've also, for instance, we've got a small scheme going, helping to rebuild a school in Japan at this very moment. So that's what we're principally organised to do.
We must remind our listeners, of course, that it is a hospital order, so we're speaking also about care in the very basic sense of caring for those who are sick and who are in need. Recently, you said that you have come back from Africa. You spoke about the order's mission in the developing countries. You were in Kenya, you were in Congo. Thinking specifically of Kenya, which at the moment, along with Ethiopia, Eritrea, Somalia, is facing one of the worst famines in decades. Your order is very committed there, is it not?
Very much. And I think that's a place where we will be probably committed for many years to come. The whole of that area, southern Sudan is part of it, Kenya in particular. One of our problems, of course, is getting access to places where we don't have a base. So at the moment, of course, it's extremely difficult to work inside Somalia in any meaningful sense. And we have to be very careful that we don't run from crisis to crisis without having completed our work during the previous crisis, if you see what I mean. So at the moment, we're very much concentrating on the northeast Kenya situation, which of course is exactly the same as Somalia, but that is actually where we are rather than over the border in Somalia. But then we have a strong organization based in Nairobi, which is able to work, as I say, firstly in Kenya, then also in southern Sudan, and then also Uganda, and then in the left-handed way, because of course Congo is such an enormous country. Although it's a country which you think of as being a West African country, of course, it stretches the whole way to the middle of Africa and beyond. So a lot of what we do in the eastern part of the Congo is actually run, as it were, from an easterly direction rather than a westerly direction. So it's the whole of that area.
But what do you do?
Well, we do different things in different places. At a very basic level, we spend a lot of time feeding people. When we're not feeding people, we provide things like tents and blankets and those sort of things, as well as basic medical care. And then, of course, in some places, we have things that are, I suppose you would call them social programs as well as medical programs, if you like. And so it's a mixture. It's a complicated mixture. One of the difficulties, of course, we have is that in an ideal world, everything you do would be based on need, whereas, of course, the reality is that sometimes there isn't money or logistic support available in a particular place. So some of it is based not on need, but on where money is available. And I'm very conscious, as all the aid organizations are, that some places that we work successfully may be next to somewhere where there's a greater need. But if you just can't get in there for one reason or another, or nobody will, as it were, produce the funding for it, well, then, of course, it's much more difficult. I mean, I think in summary, you could say we could be working in Central Africa, West, East, forever. I mean, it's a huge problems there. Absolutely enormous problems, not just health problems, social problems, even the most basic things like clean water, very little of it. And one of the things that, of course, is there's a great shortage of around the world is efficient water technicians. You know, here, you know, we're used to going to the bathroom, turning on the tap and water comes out. You know, in Africa, if you want some water, you've got to trek, you know, 50 kilometres to get it in your tin can. I mean, that's horrific, isn't it?
Absolutely. Now, looking at this order, which, you know, only time anyone speaks of the Order of Malta, immediately the images that come to mind are of the knights on that island or on their galleons floating around the Mediterranean. Mm. In the third millennium, it's a very different type of order, and you have a very different type of people who are part of that order. How do you go about attracting young people also to join
this? That's another very interesting thing. In a funny way, I don't think that, I mean, we can't get on the magic carpet, we can't get in a time machine and go and see the people who were part of the organisation 800 years ago. But I don't think human nature changes. And one of the things to remember is that when the order was originally in the Holy Land, at the very beginning, they weren't soldiers, they weren't sailors, they didn't own galleons, they were professional soldiers, I suppose, probably by training, but they were inspired to go to the Holy Land. When they got there, they found somebody looking after pilgrims, looking after the sick, and that's what they were inspired to do. So from the very, very beginning, that's what we were doing. And there's even, the scholars will tell you, that a lot of our military, at the very beginning this is, a lot of our military operations were conducted by mercenaries employed by us, but not necessarily actually ourselves. Then, of course, later on it changed because circumstances were different. The Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem collapsed. We then went to Cyprus. We then went to Rhodes and ended up in Malta. But wherever we went, wherever we've been, the very first action of the order has been to start a hospital. And they were in a very interesting position because, of course, they were in the Middle East and a great deal of medieval medicine was based on Arab scholarship. So, of course, a lot of our techniques at the very beginning were learnt from the Arabs. And we continue up to this day. And it's obviously, it's, at some moments, we've been more involved possibly perhaps on the naval, particularly during the sort of 16th and 17th centuries, because we happened to have this strategic place in the middle of the Mediterranean, and because there was a huge, as it were, problem dealing. People are inclined to think, of course, that it was all to do with fighting the Turks, but of course it wasn't. It was a whole business of policing the Mediterranean, and an enormous amount of effort was spent in dealing with the Barbary corsairs, who sailed the most extraordinary distances and collected locals from the coastal areas of Italy, Spain, even, and lots of people are unaware of it, they even sailed right through up into the Atlantic and raided the southern coast of Britain and took people off into slavery. So there was a huge, huge problem all those centuries ago, which we helped to, I don't know whether we helped to solve it, but we certainly took a great deal of part in it.
And now just very briefly, the last question. Looking ahead into this third millennium, what are the main challenges for this historic and unique order?
Well, I think the answer is it's difficult to say. Circumstances change. I mean, currently, my own view is the biggest challenge is what on earth we do about the situation in Africa. That is currently the biggest challenge. But, of course, there are also challenges in the Far East, South America. We were talking earlier about the business of the challenges even in great big rich countries like America. A lot of people who fall through the, as it were, the gaps in healthcare because the situation or the system there is that you have to have private health insurance. If there are those people who can't have it because they can't pay for it, and therefore we spend a certain amount of time in a limited way because, of course, it's such a vast place in trying to look after those people. So there are challenges all over the world. One of the other great big challenges is that everybody now lives longer. So you have in every country, not just the developing countries, but the Western countries too, you have this burgeoning population of elderly people And some places look after the elderly very well, other places don't. My own country happens to specialise in looking after the elderly. That's what they do. It just depends. A lot of it is to do with reacting to what we find in certain places.
An order that changes as the times change, but remains very much true to its founding principle.
Well, that's what we try to do. And, of course, there are dilemmas in that. There's no doubt about the fact that you have to balance living with your history and your traditions. You have to balance that with, as I say, being part of the modern world. You know, over the centuries, organisations, religious orders, whatever they might be, those that have not been prepared to change, have not been prepared to react to say, changing circumstances, have fallen by the wayside, and there are dozens of them. You know, 500, 600 years ago, there were several other religious orders of the Church, these chivalric orders, the Templars, the Holy Sepulchre, and most of them died out, and some, like the Holy Sepulchre, were refounded. But we are the only one which, by luck probably, really, rather than intelligence, I don't know, more by good luck than good management, as they say, I don't know, we are the only one which has actually survived all these centuries. So, you know, we all do our best to try and continue in that line.
You were listening there to Emma McCarthy interviewing the Grand Master of the Sovereign Order of Malta, Fra Matthew Festing. My thanks go to both of them. And now I'd like to shine the spotlight on Germany, where Pope Benedict will go on a state visit from the 22nd to the 25th of September. Not quite yet to speak of the journey itself, but to listen to a selection of readings from the writings of one of the most important lyrical poets of 20th century Germany. His name is Rainer Maria Rilke. It's an archive programme from a series on Catholic writers. The readings were selected for us by Gilbert Villacqua. Stay tuned. The most important lyrical poet of 20th century Germany was paradoxically born in Prague. And it was to the Slav world, with its long Catholic tradition, that the spirit of Rainer Maria Rilke was inevitably drawn. He was 25 when he declared, after his first journey to Russia, that he'd experienced there, for the first time in his life, something of a feeling of being at home and of belonging somewhere.
Russia, for me, meant reality, and at the same time the profound daily certainty that reality is something distant, something that comes with inexpressible slowness to those who have patience. Russia is the land where men are solitary, each with a world in himself, each filled with darkness, like a mountain.
The following autumn, Rilke wrote The Book of the Monastic Life, the first part of which became The Book of Hours, a cycle of 67 short verse meditations, supposedly of a Russian monk dialoguing with God.
You are the future, great dawn on the plains of eternity. You are the figure that is always being transformed and that always emerges alone from destiny, that remains neither acclaimed nor understood nor described, like a solitary forest.
From Rilke's second book of poems, which appeared in 1902, The Book of Images, comes the evocative Childhood.
The school's long stream of time and tediousness winds slowly on, through torpor, through dismay. Oh, loneliness! Oh, time that creeps away. Then out at last, the streets ring loud and gay, and in the big white squares the fountains play, and in the parks the world seems measureless, and to pass through it all in children's dress, with others, but quite otherwise than they. Oh, wondrous time! Oh, time that fleets away! Oh, loneliness!
Although he spent his childhood in a comfortable house in the provinces, Rilke's family was without distinction, and the poet's reminiscences were enriched by his imagination.
And out into it all to gaze and gaze, men, women, Women, men in blacks and greys, and children, brightly dressed, but differently. And here a house, and there a dog, maybe, and fear and trust changing in subtle ways. O grief uncaused, O dream, O dark amaze, O still unsounded sea. And then with bat and ball and hoop to playing in parks where the bright colours softly fade, brushing against the grown-ups without staying when ball or hoop their alien walks invade. But when the twilight comes with little swaying footsteps going home with unrejected aid, O thoughts that fade into the darkness, straying alone, afraid. And hours on end by the grey pond side, kneeling with little sailing boat and elbows bare, forgetting it because one like it stealing below the ripples, but with sails more fair, and having still to spare to share some feeling with the small sinking face caught sight of there, childhood, winged likenesses half guessed at, wheeling, oh where, oh where.
When his parents separated, Rilke was 9, and he left Prague to live in Vienna with his mother. He was to become the perennial exile, studying law in Prague and art and literature in Munich and Berlin. Rilke was always conscious of his tendency to reverie and subjective emotionalism, and he set himself the task of correcting this. His poetry gradually became more objective, and already in the Book of Images the transition is apparent. Especially in Autumn Day, in the second edition from which this poem is taken.
Lord, it is time. The summer was so great. Impose upon the sundials now your shadows, and round the meadows let the winds rotate. Command the last fruits to incarnadine, vouchsafe to urge them on into completeness, yet 2 more south-like days, and that last sweetness, inveigle it into the heavy vine. He'll not build now, who has no house awaiting, who's now alone for long will so remain. Sit late, read, write long letters, and again return to restlessly perambulating the avenues of parks, where leaves down rain.
But Rilke is a supremely spiritual poet. And in 2 poems on the Annunciation, the treatment is highly original. The first is Annunciation, Words of the Angel.
You are not nearer God than we. He's far from everyone. And yet your hands most wonderfully reveal his benison. From women's sleeves none ever grew so ripe, so shimmeringly. I am the day, I am the dew, you, lady, are the tree. Pardon now my long journey's done. I had forgot to say what he who sat as in the sun, grand in his gold array, told me to tell you, pensive one. Space has bewildered me. I am the start of what's begun. You, lady, are the tree. I spread my wings out wide and rose. The space around grew less. Your little house quite overflows with my abundant dress. But still you keep your solitude and hardly notice me. I'm but a breeze within the wood. You, lady, are the tree. The angels tremble in their choir, grow pale and separate. Never were longing and desire so vague and yet so great. Something, perhaps, is going to be that you perceived in dream. Hail to you, for my soul can see that you are ripe and teem. You lofty gate that any day may open for our good. You ear my longing songs assay. My word, I know now, lost its way in you as in a wood. And thus your last dream was designed to be fulfilled by me. God looked at me. He made me blind. You, lady, are the tree.
Rilke often used the image of the angel as a point of reference, as in this letter to a friend towards the end of his life.
Always, at the commencement of work, that first innocence must be reachieved. You must return to that unsophisticated spot where the angel discovered you when he brought you the first binding message. If the angel deigns to come, it will be because you have convinced him, not with tears, but with your humble resolve to be always beginning, to be a beginner.
Rilke believes strongly in being an eternal beginner and was never satisfied for long with any stage of achievement he'd reached, however high. He was also determined that every poem should be, however personal, not just an utterance, but a thing made, the original meaning of the Greek word poema. Here's an extract from another Annunciation, this time to the shepherds.
Look up, you men, men at the fire there, you familiar with the sky's unbounded ways, star readers hither. Look, I am a new uprising star. My being is one blaze, so filled with light the firmament is too small now to hold me and my powerful rays, for all its depth. Do let my splendor throw its beams right into you. Oh, if you only knew how even now upon each gazing face the future shines. Much will be taking place in that clear light. A new thing dawns today, for which the round earth seeks to grow more wide. God feels his way into a virgin's womb. I am the ray thrown by her inwardness, which is your guide.
In his progress towards more objective writing, Rilke found more mature expression in his collection of new poems, from which Going Blind is taken.
She'd sat just like the others there at tea, and then I'd seemed to notice that her cup was being a little differently picked up. She'd smiled once. It had almost hurt to see. And when eventually they rose and talked, and slowly, and as chance led, were dispersing through several rooms there, laughing and conversing, I noticed her. Behind the rest she walked subduedly, like someone who presently will have to sing, and with so many listening. On those bright eyes of hers, with pleasure glistening, played as on pools, an outer radiancy. She followed slowly, and she needed time, as though some long ascent were not yet by, and yet as though when she had ceased to climb, she would no longer merely walk, but fly.
In these poems, writes Rilke's translator, J.B. Leichmann, there's a wonderful balance between objectivity and subjectivity, between inwardness and outwardness, between French clarity and elegance and German intensity. Incidentally, Rilke's happiest years were spent in France, and it was there that his poetry became most popular. Rilke spent his last years in Switzerland, where he died in 1926. His life had been dedicated to poetry, and in his poetry he aimed at sublimating everything to the central theme of man's struggle for spiritual vision and clarity. As one critic writes, when he finally achieves a standpoint of complete objectivity and realism, the intense, all-pervasive spirituality of his poetry has few rivals. Let's end the program with another extract from New Poems, this time The Olive Garden.
And still he climbed, and through the grey leaves thrust, quite grey and lost in the grey olive lands, and laid his burning forehead full of dust, deep in the dustiness of burning hands. After all, this, and this then was the end. Now I am to go, while I am going blind. And oh, why wilt thou have me still contend, thou art, whom I myself no longer find? No more I find thee, in myself no tone of thee, nor in the rest, nor in this stone. I can find thee no more. I am alone. I am alone with all that human fate I undertook through thee to mitigate. Thou who art not, O shame too consummate. An angel came, those afterwards relate. Wherefore an angel? Oh, there came the night, and turned the leaves of trees indifferently, and the disciples stirred uneasily. Wherefore an angel? Oh, there came the night.
Finally, another change of pace, as I'd like to ask you to join me, and indeed our professor of fine arts, who teaches at the American University of Rome, as we stand by one of the most famous of the three fountains in Rome's Piazza Navona.
Lots of hidden elements in this fountain. It's a Baroque fountain. Water was an essential element in Baroque art.
Water and music go together for me.
I didn't say, but this is Piazza Navona. Navona meaning Agona, which meant games. In fact, it has the shape of a stadium, this
yes.
square.
It's the heart of Rome, this piazza. Bernini decided to do a fountain called the Four Rivers, meaning the four centres of the earth. He tried to pull the whole world into this little square.
Give an image of the immediate surrounding. There's a church that's built by Borromini right next to the fountain. There's a legend about this.
The legend that the four giant statues representing the four rivers, which are the Nile, the Ganges, the Danube, and the Plate in Argentina. Two of these statues, they say, are expressing a sense of horror at the work that Borromini did in the church behind it. In effect, the so-called rivalry between Borromini and Bernini can't be applied here. The church work was done afterwards. So the big giant figure with the cloth covering over its face, it means the unknown source of the Nile. It's nothing against poor Borromini. And the big giant figure on the other side, which represents the Plate River in Argentina, which has its hand raised towards the church, again, has nothing whatsoever to do with Borromini. I think it's a device used by Bernini to give a sense of drama to this fountain. Because remember, Bernini was the man who brought exotic fountains to Rome. Before that, they were just simple fountains. Here, he broke the whole concept of the formal fountain and turned it into a playful, joyful, musical harmony. You have his little water symphony. And it always makes me think of Handel's water music. You see the large rock, like it's chopped into bits all over the place, holes going through, water coming out, so you don't know exactly where the water originates here. The beauty of it, he merges the water and then all the palm trees, the lion and the horse, and on the other side then you have the coins underneath the Plate River symbol. What would you?
I can see a dolphin's tail coming out of the water.
Oh, yes, that's a little extra. He loved dolphins. Bernini was a very playful man, so he loved anything that made him happy, and you can see this in his work. And also, if you think about all these palm trees and the plants coming out of the water at the base, crawling all over the rocks, these were originally in colour. It's hard to imagine this, but they were. I often wonder what would happen if they repainted again, trying to find the original colours that he used. I think it would be quite dramatic. And then on top of this, you have obviously the big obelisk of Domitian, which was found in pieces by the Pamphili Pope, Innocent X, on the Via Appia. So he had it put on top of this fountain.
That brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Laudetur Jesus Christus.